Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. It's just me, Andrew, in the shed today for this very special episode. It's actually part one of what's going to be a double bill of episodes on October Sky, the 1999 film. We had intended to just do one episode, but Ty and I had the most wonderful time chatting to Homer Hickam the other night. And those of you who've seen the film will know that Homer is played in the film by Jake Gyllenhaal. He's the central character of the film. And after we'd finished talking to him, we realised that we just had to put the conversation out in its entirety. I'm sure you'll see why as you listen to it. And don't forget to join us for part two of our double bill on October Sky, where we're joined by Tushna Komisaria of the Institute of Physics, Physics World, and Achintya Rao of the CMS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. And Carsten Becker, who's just announced that he and the team at PT Scientists are going to be landing rovers on the moon next year. All that in part two of this. But first, here's Homer Hickam.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's a real treat for us. I'm a massive fan of the film. You know, to get an email back from that character that I love so much was just a wonderful moment for me.
Well, you know, I'm the author of the book that it's based on, so authors typically don't like the films.
Well, yes. I'm sure we're going to get into that.
But okay, we can talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I did want to start off by asking you, I mean, as a young man growing up at the height of the Cold War and with the launch of Sputnik, what was that like for you? I mean, it was an age of fear for many, but clearly it inspired you. So, I mean, what was it just simply like at that time with Sputnik launching and traveling over America?
Well, I have to kind of set the scene where I was growing up. I was growing up in a coal mining town called Coalwood, West Virginia. It was a pure company town. So I was living in a rather unique place compared to the rest of the United States. It was a town that had a long history of a company owning everything. The company owned every house, every street, every tree, every store. It even owned the church. So we were whatever religion the company said we were going to be. And the preacher was on a 3-year contract. So every 3 years we got the low bid religion, whatever it was. And it was kind of weird. Sometimes being Baptist one day and the next day you're Methodist, which was a good transition. Going back wasn't so good. One time I think we were a little bit Jewish. I'm not sure who that preacher was. He didn't last very long. But anyway, it was a unique place. And so I had grown up there my entire life. And my father by then was the superintendent of the mine. He'd started as a common mine worker. His father, my grandfather, had both his legs cut off in the mine. So all my uncles worked in the mine. Everybody I knew worked in the coal mine. And Coalwood was all that we knew. But we were also big readers. We did have television, although it had to be kind of piped in by the company, and only a few of us had television sets. So for the most part, we were all readers, very serious readers. And so I'd read a lot of science fiction and kept up with the news like everybody else. The Russians were our huge enemy, even there in Little Coalwood. We knew that we did all the duck and cover drills. We knew that the Russians at any moment might attack us for whatever reason. And President Eisenhower was our president, and we felt fairly confident in him, but we were still pretty fearful. And then we heard that the Russians had developed long-range nuclear missiles, and that made us a little bit more fearsome. And then Sputnik came along, and Sputnik was a big surprise. The Americans had announced that we were going to put a satellite into orbit before anybody for the International Geophysical Year, and that was 1957, and the Russians suddenly had beat us to it. So most of the United States and most of the Western world were just absolutely terrified by this, because it did indicate that the Russians really could put a nuclear weapon, and for all we knew, a nuclear weapon was on Sputnik. or cameras, or we had no idea what was on them. And so most of the nation just absolutely freaked out. I mean, that's all you can say. It just totally, utterly freaked out. And but I have to say that for this subset of kids, including the kids in Little Colwood, West Virginia, who read, we were in the golden age of science fiction. We had Heinlein, we had Asimov, we had all of these guys, we had read all of those books, and Tom Swift, you know, the all-American boy who was a big inventor. So we knew all this stuff. And so when Sputnik was launched, it was like, wow, that's like in our science fiction books. And we didn't ever think that would happen in our lifetime, that something would actually go into space. And then, so we were kind of intrigued on it, and we couldn't talk too much about, but we talked amongst ourselves like, wow, this is great. And so when I heard that the Russians were, or that Sputnik was actually going to fly over Colwood, I told my mother I was going to go watch Sputnik fly over. And Colwood was the kind of town where get to realize, in order to live in Colwood, all adult males had to work in the mine. That was a requirement. All adult females had to be either married to a coal miner or the preacher's wife or a teacher. That was it. So everybody knew everybody else. There was about 2,000 people in the town. And my mother then crossed over to the fence and told the neighbor lady, Mrs. Sheritz, who then crossed over to the next fence and told the neighbor lady, Mrs. Todd, and so on down the line, till everybody heard that little Sonny, that's what I was called in Colwood, Sonny, little Sonny was going to watch Sputnik fly over that night. And so I think that a good part of Colwood decided they couldn't see it anywhere else other than in my backyard. So they showed up. And hundreds of people milling around back there. And my dad walked out and said, Elsie, why are these people in our backyard? She said, Homer. Homer. Yeah, they call him the wrong name in the movie. His name's really Homer. I'm a junior. Homer, they came here to help Sonny watch Sputnik fly over. And he said, well, they can all just go home because President Eisenhower would never allow anything Russian to fly over Colwood. And but unfortunately, Eisenhower was not in charge of the laws of physics, and Sputnik did fly over Colwood. And if it had been got himself in a golden chariot, I would not have been more impressed. And so that night is when I decided I wanted to join the space race and decided to build a rocket.
Amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing. So you had a role, I think, in the on set in the films. You wrote the books. And you just said, right, sorry, this question's going all over the place, but you said that you never thought that was going to happen, that Sputnik was going to fly over. You never thought that was going to happen. I bet you didn't think that you were going to write a book about it all happening and then it was going to be made into a film.
No. Let me tell you real quick how that happened. Most people, if they only know me from the movie, think, oh, Homer, he was famous at NASA and they made this movie about him. And then, you know, and then at the end, he goes to work for NASA and everybody loves him. And it was just tremendous. And he built rockets and flew Apollo to the moon. Well, I was in Vietnam during the Apollo era. And I didn't start working for NASA till I was 38. And so it made for a good ending to the movie, the fact that I did actually end up working for NASA. But I was always a writer on the side. I'd actually already published in 1989, published a book called Torpedo Junction, which was a bestseller, even while I was working for NASA. So that was kind of, I had this little sideline passion as a writer. So, no, I didn't mean to write about Rocket Boys. I didn't think anybody would care. I did write a 2,000-word article for Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine. It was just a throwaway. You know, when I was a kid, I lived in this mining town, and these boys got together, and we built a rocket, and Miss Riley, our teacher, helped us, and my dad didn't like it, and my mom did, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's 2,000 words. And I expected that was going to be the end of it. But after it was published, my phone almost melted down. I was more surprised than anybody. The publishers were calling saying, are you going to write a book about this? And I went, well, I guess I am now. I mean, everybody's just crazy about this story. And then Hollywood started to call. And so Hollywood actually got involved just based on this short article that I'd written that didn't have a lot of detail in it. And they immediately wanted me to sign with them. All kinds of studios started coming after me to sign with them. And I ended up signing with one of the big ones. And they hired a screenplay writer who just went to town, started writing a screenplay that was just totally off the wall. And ultimately, you know, I said at the front, well, I'm an author, don't like the movie made out of it. Actually, I do like October Sky. It's just not my story. Okay. It is, but it isn't. It's missing a few things. Yeah. And that's because I wrote the book and they wrote the screenplay in parallel. And so they were getting chapters. I was sending them chapters and they were adapting it. And then sometimes they get way ahead saying, well, okay, we're going to say this happened, and I will, no, that didn't happen. And they go, yeah, it did. And I go, no, it didn't happen. And then they say, okay, all right, Homer, you just got to realize it's the Hollywood you're talking to. And I went, okay, you're right. it's a totally different art form. They ended up making a very good movie called October Sky. I actually love the movie. And but the book is significantly different and goes off in a different way. All the big points, though, are the same. It's just all the stuff in between are kind of Hollywood. That's good.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. So you mentioned Miss Riley there, and Laura Dern's character in the movie is a wonderful character. How much did she actually mean to you, Miss Riley, the teacher, in real life?
Actually, much more than they show in the movie. Miss Riley was only 5 years older than we boys. She had graduated from the same high school, valedictorian, had gone off to Teachers University and valedictorian there, and had decided to come back to the coal fields to teach. And it was only a year into her teaching that we realized that she had Hodgkin's disease. She didn't, her way of, you know, in the movie, they get kind of confused. They never really quite say she has cancer, but she does. So a little failure on the screenplay writer's part. But or actually, I guess let's say the editor's part. Let's blame it on him because we don't know who he is. So very young, beautiful woman. With Hodgkin's disease, which was incurable at that time. So she knew she only had a matter of a few years. And so she latched on to us as Big Creek, where we went to high school, was big football school. That's what it was known for, sports. Had a huge trophy case, just packed full of trophies. Nobody could beat them in football. My brother was team captain. He was big bruising guy, and I was a little squirt, four eyes, you know, I had Coke bottle glasses. Give you an idea how we got along. My brother used to introduce me as his sister. So, but Miss Riley latched on to us boys, and the word got out that we were building these rockets, and she thought that there ought to be a trophy in that trophy case for the kids who were kind of left out, the kids that were interested in other things besides sports, that there should be some recognition of them. And her idea was to, you know, have us go into science fairs. And that was not really my plan. But Quentin, the prototypical nerd who was part of our team, liked that idea. He hoped to get a scholarship out of it. By the way, there were no scholarships. None of us boys, except Quentin, got a scholarship. Quentin got a scholarship because he went to Marshall University and told him, he didn't even apply. He just went up there and said, I'm one of those boys that won that gold medal for the National Science Fair, and I'm going to school here. And they went, okay.
So, amazing.
The rest of us had to go through in different ways. Yeah. But again, that's Hollywood. I mean, how could you not have these boys get scholarships? I mean, come on. You know, so Hollywood just had to make that happen.
It was just real life that got it right.
Miss Riley was very, very important to us in that she defended us all the time. with Mr. Turner, the principal, and she's the one who went out and got us this book, Principles of Guided Missile Design, that finally showed us, we're doing a lot of trial and error and guessing, but this showed us how actually to design a very sophisticated rocket engine. Our rockets were more sophisticated than they showed in the movie, quite a bit. And so that, because it took place over a longer period of time, so it's actually 3 years of development, where in the movie they compress everything down to a few months. But she gave us that book. She bought it out of her own pocket, probably cost over $100, which was, that was a lot of money back then. And the librarian went in with her, Miss Bryson, for the book. And when she gave us that, it was basically the challenge that, okay, you're fooling around here, you're blowing things up, you're stinking up the whole town, maybe you can do something real here by learning everything in that book. And Quentin looked in that book and said, well, this is wonderful. It requires a working knowledge of calculus and differential equation. And looked at me and said, yeah, Sonny, you're having trouble with algebra right now. How are you going to do this? So that was the challenge, was to learn these. It wasn't taught. Calculus and differential equations and all this higher math was not taught in the school. But Miss Riley went to bat for us and got us the courses. So she was very, very more important and very much more active than what they show in the movie.
When it comes to Hollywood adapting your life story, I imagine, like you said, they made loads of changes. They also like turned Sherman Sears and Jimmy O'Dell into Sherman O'Dell and show you stealing steel to make your rockets. And like you said, your dad's name was Homer, but it's John in the film. And they show you meeting Wernher von Braun. Was there anything that particularly grated with you about the changes they made? And also, on the other hand, was there anything that you didn't mind?
Actually, I don't mind all that. I'm sure my dad, had he been alive, would have much preferred they didn't use his real name. Yeah, he would not have wanted to have been a part of this whole thing. Yeah. So he would have been happy about that. Now, the one I really I had a lot of fun. My wife and I were on set during the whole thing and got to know all the actors. I taught Jake Gyllenhaal how to run. He didn't know how to run. He ran like a Beverly Hills, California boy. I said, nah.
They would beat you up so fast if you ran like that, Jake. Let me show you how to, you got, you know. So he was kind of like a little rabbit. But anyway.
We had a lot of fun making the movie. I didn't like, and I still don't like, that they had me quitting school and working in the mine. That would have never happened. My parents would have lived in a tree before they would ever let me quit school. My mom would probably just killed me on the spot. she'd have borrowed a pistol from the neighbor and just come out and killed me. And there would not have been a West Virginia jury that would have convicted her. They would have said, yeah, we understand, Mrs. Hickam, you have to do these things sometimes. But so I argued strenuously against that plot device. But I came to understand it and even almost appreciate it. And that was that Joe Johnston, the director, came to me and said, Homer, we have to let, in a Hollywood movie, we have to let the hero confront the villain. We got two choices here. Your dad can be the villain, or the coal mine can be the villain. And in order for you to confront, if we're going to make it the coal mine, that's what you want. You don't want your dad to be the villain. I went, no, he's not. And I said, okay. The coal mine itself is the villain, and you have to confront it. Therefore, we're going to come up with this plot device where you quit school. I know you don't like it, but okay, you're going to quit school and you're going to go work in the coal mines and confront the villain. And I just, you know, it's like, okay, we'll do it. And it worked. It actually works. As little Jake goes down the shaft, though, and looks up and sees Sputnik fly over at that moment, it's like, I told them, that's the dumbest thing. Nobody will ever accept that. I mean, maybe they'll think it's a pigeon. They won't even know what it is that's flying. But everybody knows. I was absolutely astonished by that. Everybody loves it. People cry. They break out into tears at that moment. I go, okay, yeah, you're right and I'm wrong. It's a different art form, no question.
I mean, my view of that was, I mean, I kind of, I don't believe it. I just feel the poetry of it.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. And after all, they had dug the little hole that this thing went down in, and they had to do something with it. So they wanted to show him going down and then looking up. Oh, we had some good times on set. No question about it. It was fun.
Definitely had generated a reaction afterwards. And there was the October Sky Festival that happened in Colwood up until about 2012, when I think there weren't enough residents in Colwood for it to become a reality. But you used to attend the festival quite a lot. Could you tell us a bit about that and what happened?
Yeah, well, I still attend the festival. It's held in another town about 40 miles from Colwood because it's bigger. And it's called Beckley, and it's a place where there's an exhibition coal mine there, and it's also easily accessible. Colwood is very difficult to access. When the book came out and the movie came out, people said, you know, I think I drove through Colwood one time, and I laugh and say, no, you have to actually be going there to get there. You can't just happenstance drive through Colwood. It's deep in these mountains. Matter of fact, that's why they didn't film it there, because you only see the sun between like 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. The mountains are so close together, and so they didn't have enough light really to film it there. And the roads are so twisty, curvy, that it's school buses that were coming into the October Sky Festival. The kids were all car sick and everything by the time they got there. And they also were passing through areas that looked like a war zone, because when I grew up in the county, MacDowell County, there were actually 120,000 people that lived in this county. Now there's 12,000. So there's been just this huge collapse of the population and the infrastructure there, and all these buildings and whole towns just collapsing and falling down. And so these kids had to go through all of that to get to Colwood, which is still okay. It was still a little oasis, but it was still scary for a lot of them. So after 13 years in Colwood, the townspeople were ready to give it up, because they're my age. They were aged. They were about 1 foot in the grave. And so they decided that to let the larger town have it. I will say, though, when the movie came, the movie was not very popular. It came out, and they released it in the kind of the drop dead month of February in 99. It stayed in the theaters for a few weeks, and then it just was kind of thrown away after that. But what happened afterwards was just amazing. It got discovered by teachers, for one thing. So they started showing it to all their classes. And then the book, of course, became really, really popular all around the world. And so they kind of fed off each other. The book got real popular for a long time, more popular than the movie, which fed back into the movie. The movie then got popular, which fed back into the book. I think we got about 20 international publishers now for Rocket Boys, including Vietnamese, which thrilled me. The State Department asked me to go to Vietnam and talk to Vietnamese students to come to the United States to go to university. And Rocket Boys in Vietnamese was coming out just that time. So I went back to where I was in the 4th Infantry Division over there in 67, 68. So I went back there. I would never have gone back otherwise. Yeah. And it was great. I mean, you talk about love. I got almost loved to death. They tried to kill me the first time. The second time, they tried to love me to death. So, so it's been a very, very wonderful ride. And somehow, October Sky became a kind of a classic movie. And it's pretty amazing. It was just a story that was going to bust out almost no matter how it was told. It was just going to bust out.
Absolutely. So but after Vietnam, you did eventually start to work at NASA. Did it feel like eventually to you, did you kind of always have that trajectory and think, I'm going to work there, and then it eventually happened? Or
I did always want to work there, but after Vietnam, I worked for the Army as a civilian, and because that was, well, really about the only job I could get. Worked as an engineer for the Army Missile Command, and then lived over in Germany for 3 years, from 78 to 81, working for the Army Training Command over there. And I'd actually taken a job with the Navy to come back to the United States after that, down in Florida, but just on a whim. And, you know, they say, my mom always said, God looks after fools, drunks, the United States of America, and my little sonny boy. And I think what happened was that somebody was looking after me, and just on a whim, I decided to apply to NASA. Why not? You know, and lo and behold, I got hired back here in Huntsville. And so I had to take a cut in pay, actually, to come back and work for NASA, but I hit it at an extraordinary time, just as the shuttle started to fly, and assigned to a program that was working hand in glove with the Europeans and the Japanese, the Space Lab program. And so I ended up training the astronauts. I did two things. I went out to the principal investigators, that's what they call scientists. I mean, with NASA, two words is always better than one, right? So all our scientists are called principal investigators. So I would actually go to their site and say, okay, we've got to train the astronauts. What do you got? Show me what you got. And they'd haul out all this laboratory equipment. And I'd look at that and go, so you can't actually fly that. You know that. You have to actually put it in a box or something. They go, oh, yeah, we're working on that real, real hard. And so the astronauts are going to have to do this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And then we want them to do that. And I went, you know what the astronauts want? I'll tell you what they want. And I'm just going to cut through all the haze. Here's what they want. On the outside, when you put all this laboratory equipment inside this box, put a great big button. Well, you can maybe two, but one's better. Put a great big red button on it that says start, stop. That's all they want. And they go, well, we can't do that. And I go, all right, we'll work. We'll work it. And so then I would, they'd go off and do that for a while. And then I would have to end up training the astronauts to operate whatever it is. I say I, but it'd be my team would actually figure out how we were actually going to train the astronauts to operate that piece of scientific equipment. And I was a scuba instructor, so I also was working. Immediately, they called me over to start working in the neutral buoyancy simulator, which is the big tank where you go underwater, the astronaut in the suit, or sometimes it would be me and some of the other guys. We'd go inside the suit and go underwater and work on mock-ups like the Hubble Space Telescope. So when the Hubble telescope was found to be nearsighted, which I had nothing to do with, but when it was found to be nearsighted, and on TV they were calling it the Hubble Space Paperweight, we knew we had to rescue that. So I was on the team that came up with all the fixes and how we were actually going to send Story Musgrave and Kathy Thornton and the other astronauts out there to fix it. So that was quite an adventure right there. And training the first Japanese astronauts, I'd have to say, were the high points of my NASA career.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much for fixing Hubble.
I think Hubble is NASA's finest moment since Apollo, to my mind. That was the most important thing that NASA has done and to date. And that includes the International Space Station. I think the Hubble is more important. Not to say that ISS is not important, but the Hubble has really opened up the universe to us. And I think that 100 years from now, I hope that we have a lot more Hubbles coming. And yeah, not only Hubbles in low Earth orbit, but Hubbles out in the around Pluto and everywhere else. So we can really see out there.
Yeah. Amazing. Can you, so you still follow then, NASA? You still watching everything that's going on there?
Well, I live in Huntsville, Alabama, which is kind of Rocket City, USA. The Marshall Space Flight Center is here. And Huntsville, a lot of people across the world think that Houston is where all the important work is done. Actually, they only train those creatures called astronauts. And we used to do a major part of it, obviously, because I did it here. But Marshall here in Huntsville builds everything else. So when you look at the Apollo moon rocket, the Saturn V, the only part that Houston built was that little tiny tin can right on the top.
Yeah.
Which actually, we could have built it that in Colwood, probably out of a washer and dryer. You know, we could have done that. Yeah. So everything below that it was Huntsville. So living in this town, yes, I hear it all the time. I get an earful about NASA all the time. And also, I'm on the board out at Space Camp called the U.S. Space and Rocket Center is their official title. So I'm out on the board there and the world famous Space Camp. And we have a lot of folks, a lot of kids and adults from the UK come over here all the time and all around the world. And so I keep my hand in it a little bit that way. For the most part, though, I spend my time writing and that's, you know, I had twin passions. One of them was space and the other one was writing. So I've been very lucky and to be able to do both.
Okay. You've made a musical out of the Rocket Boys book, haven't you?
Yeah, we made Rocket Boys the musical. And, well, we'll see how that goes. There's some controversy about that right now. So I can't really get into that. There's some legal problems.
Okay, we'll leave that. We'll leave that.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I mean, what can they do? They can kill me, but they can't eat me. That's what I always... Well, they might. Okay. But I can tell you, it's a very good musical. And the day will come, I'm confident that it will... The whole world will be singing these songs.
I can't wait for that day. I can't wait.
I do have one final question that, as you're from a cold town, you might have an interesting perspective of. And that is, with the current... with President Trump repealing all of Obama's environmental acts and therefore, in his words, ending the war on coal, as someone who's from a West Virginian mining town, do you think that's actually going to help the coal industry in any way? Or do you think that the age of coal is over and what his actions might be hampering future America energy prospects? I'd really be interested in your thoughts on America's future with coal as someone who kind of grew up with it.
Well, it's a very complex subject, and I'm not sure, but I have a simple answer about it. Naturally, I gave it a lot of thought. I still know a lot of people back in West Virginia who depend on the coal industry or have, and I'm very sympathetic. But here's the reality of it. Let's let the market play out. The fact is that most of the coal out of West Virginia is not used for energy. It's used to make steel. So, you know, in the movie where my dad says, coal fails, steel fails, and if steel fails, the country fails. Well, okay. Most people think all that coal that's dug up is just used to burn and you get all this pollution and all this kind of stuff. And actually, that's not true. Most of the coal that's burned for energy comes out of the West around Wyoming. It's all strip coal. So the idea of bringing the deep coal mines back will be the steel industry in the country will have to go up. So it's not just a matter of eliminating environmental regulations. Unless there's a market for it, nobody's going to go out there and go down 800 feet and dig out this metallurgical coal. And even if they do, and I think they will, already... some mines are reopening in West Virginia, even prior to President Trump, because steel around the country, around the world, needs its coal. 10 men now can do what 500 used to be able to do. And so in order, it won't ever come back the way it was. And so for those areas, what I want is non-extractive industries to come in there. In other words, industries that are not based on coal or natural gas or forestry, or it needs to be something else. And it won't ever come back. We won't ever come back to the population that we had back then. But I think you could get a nice stable population in there if you didn't continue to wish the past would come back. But the past is never going to come back. But coal will always be dug. It's just too valuable a resource, but it just won't be dug as much, and it'll be dug for, I think, mostly for steel. And then what we'll see is some balance will come. I mean, I think that it's so cheap when you bring it out of Wyoming in these places that it's almost impossible to overnight go to other types of energy. It has to be kind of a transitional thing. And I think that's what we're going to see. No matter what the President of the United States does or anybody else does, market forces ultimately make the decisions everywhere. And that's what's going to happen with coal and the whole area where I grew up.
Ty said that was the last question. It wasn't. I've got two more.
I'm just a writer, and I'm able to put off writing by talking to you.
So you're obviously a science fiction fan back in the day. Are you still a fan?
I'm kind of an eclectic reader, whatever just grabs me at any moment. I'm writing, or I have just actually finished writing a screenplay about the fellow who found Pluto. By the way, if you know any producers listening out there, if you want a great screenplay that will actually everybody in the entire world and possibly even on Pluto will want to see, then you need to get hold of me, and I'll be happy to help you there. But in the process of doing that, I started reading a whole lot about life in the United States in the early 20th century, late 19th century. I've just finished reading about 20 books on life during that era. And it's fascinating always when you go back and read history to see the parallels between then and now and in the past as well, you know. So a lot of my reading is done as part of the research that I do.
You're actually a big advocate of Pluto being returned to planet status, aren't you?
It is a planet. I don't care what anybody says.
I'm not disputing. Neil deGrasse Tyson might disagree, but...
I know Neil deGrasse Tyson. I met him one time in the green room, and he was a young man on the make then, and now he's an older man on the make. So.
Amazing.
He likes to say controversial stuff, okay? So he knows he can get a rise out of everybody by saying Pluto's not a planet. Well, you know, if you were in a spaceship and you were flying past it and you looked out the window, you'd go, "Well, my stars, Hazel, I think we're flying past a planet."
You know, there'd be no doubt you're flying past a planet. I mean, use common sense. There it is.
So they can do. I know what the problem is. The problem is there are going to be a lot more Plutos out there, in the Oort cloud, and they just don't want to get into that. And it's like, okay, so we got a solar system that's got 100 planets. Big deal. Get over it, you know. And it's fine. We're all good with that. And just stop messing. See who they're messing with are guys like me from the baby boomer generation. Actually, I'm a little earlier than the baby boomers, but anyway. We grew up with 9 planets, and by golly, that's in our heads, 9 planets. And they can just say, no, it's 8 all they want to, and that's never going to get out. Miss Riley taught me 9 planets.
We grew up with 9 planets as well.
That 9th planet was Pluto.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And they can all just take a flying leap into the Oort cloud, as far as I know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But we've got these amazing images of Pluto now as well. I mean, you can't look at that and just not. I mean, it's better than a planet.
Yeah, you're right. It's better than a planet. It shouldn't want to be part of these other 8.
Yeah.
It should.
These other 8, for instance, Pluto has a heart on it.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that's not God telling us something.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't put it there until we started saying it wasn't a planet, and then God just went, right, there you are.
First he drew the dog, Pluto the dog, and he went, that's too obvious, so I'm gonna
It's too on the nose.
Let's assume that everybody who's listening to this podcast has read Rocket Boys.
Yeah.
What book should they read next?
They ought to go ahead and read the, I mean, once you get started, let's keep going. Let's read all the Colwood books. That's The Colwood Way and Sky of Stone. And then the prequel is Carrying Albert Home, which, by the way, is very popular over in the UK. It was number one there for a while. And we're hoping that that a movie producer will step up and make a movie out of carrying Albert home. And if it was a UK producer, director, I would like that actually better. So we're hoping that we'll get some action on carrying Albert home, which is about my mom's alligator.
Your
mom's alligator.
It'll make you laugh. And then the other books, there's so many of them.
I personally, if you're interested in the adventure and the ocean and all that, then you'll want to read my Josh Thurlow series, starting with The Keeper's Son. But if you like young adult science fiction, there's the Crater series, Crater, Crescent, and Crater, True Blood, and the Lunar Rescue Company. And my personal favorite is The Dinosaur Hunter, which is based on it's not a memoir or anything, but it comes from me going out every summer to Montana to hunt dinosaur bones. And I have to brag on myself a little bit, my little team. Do you know how many T-Rex has ever been found? It is 35, around 35, maybe 40, depending on how you look at it, T-Rex has ever been found. And I found two of them, and the little two-man team I'm on has found a total of five. So Miss Riley's going to mess with me here, but we have found one out of eight T-Rexes ever found.
Wow.
So The Dinosaur Hunter is based on all of that, and so you might want to read that.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I do.
I saw an article on The Guardian today that said new research seems to indicate that the T-Rex was a very tender lover. Do you know anything about that at all?
I imagine he was pretty impressive in that department. Unfortunately, or fortunately, those don't fossilize very well. And we haven't found one, but I imagine Mrs. T-Rex was pretty happy, with a pretty happy lady.
Brilliant. So, yeah, this is the most revealing interview we've ever done.
About T-Rexes, definitely. Yeah. Listen, this is so wonderful. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to do it.
Have you still been following Jake Gyllenhaal's career?
Oh, yeah. Well, my wife likes him, and I do too, actually. And so he was a sweet boy. He really was. He was only 16 when we made the movie, and I guess he's almost 30 now, maybe more. And gosh, it was a long time ago when we made that movie. It was 20 years ago. So I was somewhat younger 20 years ago. But Jake's a sweet boy, and he worked really hard on that movie. I'll give you some quick insight. Jake was 16. The other boys were in their 20s when we made that movie, and so all the restrictions generally for young people on movies did not apply to the other boys. And we were in this rather rustic town in Tennessee where we made it. And so the other boys every night could be found down at the local Walmart picking up the local girls. And Jake, however, had to go back to the hotel with his mother. And so if Jake looks distressed during this movie, it wasn't entirely acting.
I'm sure he has no problems with the ladies now.
No, it was like,
come to the set and work all day. And by the way, he had to take classes. I think he was taking French or something because he was still in high school. And then go back to the hotel with his mother and then back to the set. That's all he did for 3 months. It was only supposed to be like a 4 or 5 week shoot, but it ended up being a 3 month shoot for a variety of different reasons. And so I didn't mind. I liked hanging out with Laura Dern. And so they could have made it 3 years as far as I was concerned. But yeah, so we do keep up with little Jake and wish him well.
I will ask you another question since we're here. Your relationship with your dad in the film compared to real life?
Well, it's a lot more complicated, of course. Again, Hollywood's, it's an art form, and you only have a few scenes. Where in the book, I have a long time. And I actually, all three books, the the Colwood Way and Sky of Stone actually expands more on my father. Sky of Stone is really more about my dad. And then Carrying Albert Home is about my mom and dad in the 1930s, well before I was born. And we can see who he actually is. My dad was very much an intellectual. He read constantly. His mind went to places where mine couldn't go, really, probably still, and philosophical. He had a classical education that he taught to himself. He was trained by a Stanford University graduate engineer, one of the best mining engineers in the country, called Captain Laird. My dad became recognized as probably the best mining engineer in the country. And so he was a lot more, he had a lot more layers to him than what they show in the movie. And actually our conflict, they simplified our conflict, was that he wanted me to work in the mine, and actually he didn't. He wanted me to be a mining engineer, which kind of ratchets up the stakes there a little bit, as versus an aerospace engineer. And so and I agreed with the movie makers on that. That gets to be, I mean, that's going to take a lot more scenes to explain about mining engineering versus aerospace engineering. If you just say, I want you to stay here in Colwood. He did want me to stay, in that he wanted me to go off to university, get the degree that he didn't have, and then come back and essentially keep this way of life going in Colwood, this company town life, and kind of keep the Hickam philosophy of living in a town like that and supporting the people and keeping the people employed by bringing in the best possible mining engineering. He brought in all kinds of new techniques into Colwood, which kept it going probably about 10 years longer than it would have otherwise. All of that was going on. So, like I say, it was much more complicated. And my mother was much more of a strong personality, as you'll understand when you read the book, than they showed in the movie. But again, it's a different art form. You can only do so much. You only have an hour and a half to 2 hours to tell the story. And over a period of time, I recognized what they were doing. I learned a lot by seeing what they were doing. And I know that the movie inspires people around the world. They love it. They cry. And they should. And it's just a dear, dear story and a dear, dear movie. And it's one that I'm proud that I was part of.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that's it for part one. Part two coming soon with that interview with Carsten Becker of PT Scientists, Achintu Rao from the Large Hadron Collider, and Toshna Kamisariat from Physics World, and of course, Ty and myself. Oh, and thank you so much to everybody who gave us such wonderful feedback for our episode on Hidden Figures. It's so nice to hear from you all. And don't forget, you can get in touch with us through our Facebook page, on Twitter at The Cosmic Shed, or through the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com. And thank you very much for listening. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.